I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Just when you thought it was safe to put your trust and your hard-earned savings back in Wall Street's pocket, scandal strikes again. Today, the nation's $7 trillion mutual fund industry is being rocked by allegations of illegal and unethical behavior. Some traders are accused of using various schemes to skim extra dollars for themselves and certain privileged insiders at the expense of the average investor. Heads have already rolled two of the largest mutual fund companies. With congressional hearings continuing in Washington and the Securities and Exchange Commission and state attorneys general on the case, more may follow. State treasurers are taking their pension funds elsewhere, and there's talk of criminal charges and perp walks for more top executives. So this hour we're asking, what are you going to do if you have money in a mutual fund? What do you want regulators to do to keep your savings safe? Beyond the details of this latest scandal, do you feel the big investment companies have your interests at heart, or does greed rule the street? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be hearing from several guests over the course of the next hour, starting with Ian McDonald, who covers the mutual fund industry for The Wall Street Journal and has been writing a lot about this, clearly. Hi, Ian, and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, according to the SEC, there are some 95 million Americans who are invested in mutual funds. So clearly, this is big. Give us a quick update on how we got here.
Well, what we're really talking about are a couple of infractions, and it's important to understand what each is and how they're different. One is market timing, and one is called late trading. Market timing is not illegal per se. It's when someone makes rapid trades in and out of a given fund. They might do so because, for some reason, they think the securities in that fund, the sector it invests in, the securities it holds, are due to rise a lot the next day. Or they may be trying to arbitrage stale prices. If the fund, for instance, if it's a Japanese fund and it all funds price their securities at the end of the U.S. trading day at 4 p.m. Eastern time, if they don't update those prices from the Japanese trading day, they may be up to 14 hours old. So if, for instance, the U.S. market has a big day and those old prices are in the Japan funds, used in valuing the Japan fund shares, someone could hop in, book a profit the next day on those Japanese securities, and then hop out again. As I said, it's not illegal, but most funds claim to shun it in their prospectuses. That's how they represent their policies. Some apparently did not actually follow through and do that. The reason why it's a problem is that it raises expenses, thus whittling the returns for people like you and I who are longer-term holders. So that's market timing. Now, if we look at late trading, that is illegal. It does violate securities laws. As I said, funds value their shares by valuing what they own in the portfolio at 4 p.m. Eastern time. That's the end of the U.S. trading day. What a late trader does is that person buys shares at a given day's price set at 4 p.m. hours later. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has basically likened this to betting on a horse race that's already run. If you've seen the movie The Sting, that's essentially the idea there, too. They're past posting. It's an old idea where you essentially are betting on races that are already over. So that violates securities laws, and market timing does not, but there is a question about whether or not funds are actually at least being unfair, if not committing fraud, by saying one thing and doing another.
Exactly. I was going to say, I mean, if these are either illegal or unethical, some of them, you know, maybe both, how widespread is this? One figure I've seen is about half of the 88 largest firms that offer mutual funds?
Yes, the SEC has finished a survey of the 88 largest firms in the nation ranked by assets. Just for a little perspective, that does cover a vast percentage of the assets invested in mutual funds. That's a pretty good idea of what's going on out there. And they found that about half of them did have some market timing agreements. This is something that was – the market timing was sort of an open secret in the business to a degree where people knew that there were some folks out there trying to do it. It was assumed that they were a vast minority and that funds were policing this. And a lot of them were, to be fair, a lot of firms out there were doing this, but clearly not to the degree that any of us thought. And we're really, between this and the late trading, it's just deeply, deeply disappointing.
Mm. And as we've seen over the last few days, Putnam has responded by reorganizing its top management. Robert Strong has resigned from the Strong Mutual Fund. Is that enough to have the top people kind of falling on their swords, or is this a larger issue within corporate culture that just the top guys going isn't going to solve?
I think that latter part of what you said is a fair representation. I mean, whether Larry Lasser, who was formerly the chief executive of Putnam, is in the building or out of the building is not really going to fix the issue. He was not the person doing this. It's his responsibility and the person at the top of a company's responsibility to – that's why they make the big bucks. Let's face it. They're in charge of what's going on below them and being aware of what's going on. These folks obviously took their eye off the ball. Dick Strong is in a worse situation where he's accused of timing his own firm's funds, essentially whittling the returns of customers who trusted him with their money. I believe Paul Roy is going to speak with you folks today. He is the top policy person at the SEC overseeing the $7 trillion fund business, and he'll have a lot of insight into some fixes that might make sense on the policy side. The one thing that people should keep in mind is that this is a very – it sounds simple maybe to an outsider, but it's a very difficult thing to get at. What we're looking at, what went on here, was a lot of collusion. And if say, you or I decide to get together and you stamp a trade ticket 4 o'clock and I buy that fund at 6 o'clock, the SEC or any regulator is not going to find out about that unless someone tips them off, because there isn't really a trail. It's going to take a lot of thought. And the one thing we should all be concerned about is that we don't confuse motion with progress. When something as abusive and disappointing as this happens, everyone kind of wants to get in on the act of redrawing securities laws. But it's really, really important that we do this right and that we really think it through. And Paul's going to be a big part of that.
Well, speaking of Paul, let's bring him into the conversation now. He is director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC, which, as you pointed out, Ian, means that he is responsible for oversight of this entire $7 trillion mutual fund industry. And he's at the NPR studios in Washington. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Gail. It's a pleasure to be here, and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your people calling in this morning.
Well, Ian made a point a moment ago about one of the best ways to find out that this sort of thing is going on is being tipped off. The SEC was tipped off. Sounds as if somebody was asleep at the wheel.
Well, I think that, as Ian, he gave you an excellent example of the types of abuses and problems that we're dealing with and trying to hold the wrongdoers accountable. The initial tip came into the New York Attorney General. He followed through on it. We have gotten subsequent tips and are in the midst of a comprehensive investigation of the activities that Ian outlined for you. And I think that it's important, that when we uncover activity like this, that we do a thorough job on behalf of America's investors to understand the scope and the breadth of this problem. And unfortunately, as Ian pointed out, it is fairly widespread. It's not only mutual funds colluding with broker-dealers and other folks who sell fund shares are involved in this. And then we also have the activity of hedge funds who make a strategy out of this. Our objective is to focus on the wrongdoers, to hold them accountable, to make sure that the fines and penalties, and indeed in some cases this amounts to criminal activity, those wrongdoers are held accountable.
What about the whistleblower who came to the Boston SEC office last spring and told them what was going on at Putnam and apparently couldn't get anybody too excited about it?
Well, that's an area of concern, and obviously, we're looking at that situation trying to understand what we didn't do, what we should have done. We get probably 1,000 tips a day, 1,000 emails and communications from investors. We try to take them all seriously and follow through on them. Indeed, that's where we get a lot of our cases from. It's not only just going out and doing examinations and trying to find deficiencies and problems, but indeed we get a lot of our cases from people bringing information to our attention, and we definitely want to make sure that we focus on that. It's something that Chairman Donaldson has made a priority at the agency, and we're going to improve our procedures and processes there. And all I can really tell you about that situation is that we're looking at it and trying to understand, where we went wrong.
Mm. Well, at this point, do you see this as a few bad apples or pervasive bad practice in some of these companies, a corporate culture that chose to look the other way?
Yeah, it's clear that it's more than a few bad apples, and that's really unfortunate. There's a real betrayal here, I think, on the part of particularly in the mutual fund industry, an industry that has fiduciary obligations, an industry that is serving small investors. There's a real betrayal here, and I think Ian hit on it when he said it's you have to have a culture in the organization that is committed to fulfilling and following through on those fiduciary obligations. And, where we find people who've breached that duty, betrayed investors, they have to pay a price for it. I'm in the division that handles the rulemaking and the policy in this area, and we can write rules. And indeed, as Ian outlined, a lot of this activity is illegal. There are aspects of the market timing investigation and things that we uncover that are clearly illegal, just out-and-out fraud, trading on material non-public information. And those types of situations, we have to hold the wrongdoers accountable and make sure that penalty is severe enough that we discourage this type of activity in the future. We can have all the rules and statutes on the books, but if people figure they can get away with it, they'll do it. And we need to move appropriately in that area, and working with the state regulators, the NASD, to make sure that we send the right message.
All right. I want to bring Gary Gensler into the conversation now. He has spent 18 years on Wall Street. He was one of the youngest partners at Goldman Sachs, also served in top positions in the Treasury Department during the Clinton administration, and has written a book called The Great Mutual Fund Trap. Gary, so welcome to the program.
Gail, good to be with you and your listeners.
And do you see this as a betrayal?
Oh, I think this is very much a betrayal. I was encouraged by hearing Paul's words that the SEC sees it that way as well. I wish that this was only narrow and a few bad apples, but at its core, it's very revealing that the entire mutual fund system is based on a false premise. It's a false premise that they are working for you and me and your listeners as investors. They're not really working for us as investors. They're working for their management companies and the shareholders of those management companies and the profits that they represent. I think Congress and the SEC recognized that way long ago and set up a pretty good law back in 1940 where there should be independent directors looking out for investors' interests as a governing body, really working on our behalf. And I'm hopeful that with this scandal developing, there might be renewed vigor and focus by those boards of trustees in thinking as fiduciaries, or maybe it's new vigor from the SEC to really change the culture of what the fiduciary duties are of those boards. And so some good could come out of this, but right now I think the whole system is broken.
Ian, just very quickly before we have to say goodbye to you, do you think the whole system is broken?
I think what we're really looking at is the fact that in the 1990s, in the fund business, it was largely, and in the 80s too, it was largely a business of a land grab, where everybody was trying to get more 401k plans and more market share. And what happened was the folks in the sales part of the business ascended. They became the gatekeepers, and frankly, they were incented to bring money in, and there was not enough attention paid to protecting the customers you already had.
All right, Ian McDonald from the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much. We'll look forward to reading more of your work on this topic. Connection listeners, we're talking this hour about the investment tool that 95 million Americans are using to save for retirement or their kids' college education. We invite you to join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Mutual funds in the minds of many people have a benign reputation, but listen to what Senator Peter Fitzgerald of Illinois said at a congressional hearing earlier this week. He said, quote, "The mutual fund industry is now the world's largest skimming operation, a $7 trillion trough from which fund managers, brokers, and other insiders are steadily siphoning off an excessive slice of the nation's household, college, and retirement savings." strong words, which we'd like to talk about with you. If you are in the industry or if you are an investor, we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we are speaking this hour with Paul Roy, who's the top person at the Securities and Exchange Commission, responsible for oversight of the mutual fund industry, and Gary Gensler, a former Wall Street banker and Treasury Department official, and a harsh critic of today's mutual fund industry. Gary, I want to start with you because there seems to be this notion among many investors that a mutual fund is, in fact, very safe, very secure. It's almost like putting your money in the bank, except that you expect to get a higher return. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, I think Senator Fitzgerald summed it up very well. Mutual funds started with a great concept that we could join together as investors and get the benefit, mutually get the benefit of lower cost and diversification. That means buy a lot of stocks throughout the market and do it together so we can get lower costs and maybe even tap some good expertise along the way. What's wrong with the picture is that as the mutual fund industry has grown, they have not continued to give us the benefits of that collective mutual behavior. We're not getting the low fees that you could get. If a Fidelity Magellan fund is $60 billion, do they really need to charge close to 1% of $60 billion to manage that? Now, we know 1% of $60 billion is a very big number. It's $500 to $600 million a year, most of it going to Fidelity Management Company as profits. Now, God bless America if Fidelity Management Company can earn that $500 million a year. That's capitalism at work. But investors should really think for themselves and use common sense and a little bit of arithmetic and say, why pay all those fees?
Do you think it's because people just don't notice it? I mean, you notice it when you go to the ATM and there's that $1.50 charge and there
really,
it is and you're mad.
It's really remarkable how mad we all get over those fees at the ATM. And this is the greatest system to charge as a percentage of net worth. If a plumber walked in your door and said, to fix that sink, I'm going to ask you your net worth, you'd throw the plumber out. But here, it's a wonderful system if you can get it. It might be time to buy stock in mutual fund companies, not to invest in their products.
So basically, this money is subtracted from whatever you're making, and so you tend to not pay that much attention to
it. That's right. And it's not just the disclosed fees. Paul and the SEC has many disclosure regimes they have to tell you about. It's also the undisclosed cost of all that trading. They trade normally the stocks, 80% of the stocks they sell and buy back in a given year. And secondly, they trigger many taxes, short-term capital gains taxes, when good investors invest for the long run. So all told, it's about 3% of your money every year goes to management fees, trading costs, taxes. These are well-documented costs that unfortunately eats into retirement savings, as Senator Fitzgerald said.
And eats significantly into it.
Yes, over a 40-year time, you could give up 30 or 40% of your savings. So, candidly, some of my old pals could have better vacations in the Hamptons.
All right, let's go to
Gail,
the phone.
Could I jump in here?
Sure, quickly, and then we want to go to our phone lines, Paul.
Sure.
Thanks.
I just want the listeners to kind of understand the regulatory framework that we're dealing with. The Congress didn't put the SEC in the role of sort of a rate maker or a fee setter, the way utility commissions are in a lot of the jurisdictions around the country. You know, our role is, as Gary pointed out, is to force disclosures about these fees so that investors can make intelligent decisions among funds. And I think Gary, you know, points up some issues that we quite frankly have to deal with. There are mutual fund prospectuses where there's a standard fee table, but there are additional fees and incentives that brokers have that we are working on trying to surface in terms of clear and plain disclosures for investors. And I think, from a regulatory policy standpoint, that has to be one of our focuses.
How could you do that, Paul? I mean, do you have your own public service announcement saying, watch out for the fine print, folks?
Well, I think if, for example, if your listeners go to our website, the SEC's website, They'll find a wealth of information in terms of investing in funds, how to, you know, what costs to look for, what questions to ask. We have a cost calculator on our website that allows you to take the information that's in a fund prospectus with all the different fee structures and arrangements and compare one fund to another so you can see how those costs eat into your returns over time. And Gary's absolutely right. Those costs are really important, and they can erode your returns.
All right, and we're going to have a link to your site on our site at theconnection.org. So a good way to get that information. Let's go to our phone lines now and hear from Robert, who's on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. I guess my comment is I think I represent some investors in that there's no way that I'm investing in market equities or in any kind of mutual fund until there's evidence of ethical behavior. And if there's a system that enforces ethical behavior in place, I think there's been a de facto conspiracy between the people who are running large corporations. The most egregious examples are the CEOs of Cox, Adelphia, Enron, WorldCom, who have committed out-and-out fraud. There's the outrageous executive pay packets that show the hubris. The second element is the people who are investing in these large corporations, such as mutual funds, putting them, of course, in the headlines now. There's a well-documented fraud on the part of the people who have been financing and analyzing the large corporations and IPOs, Merrill Lynch, CSFB. And the people who are investing amounts in behalf of rich investors, the hedge funds. So you have these four elements of people who are responsible for trillions of dollars who are all verifiably behaving unethically. And I think it's a message to people like me whether or not we decide to put their money in to the market.
All right, Robert, let's get Gary's response on that point. Gary, are you concerned that this is going to spill over into other aspects of investing? Lack of confidence is a tough one to get back once you lose it.
Well, I agree with Robert, and I believe, as Robert does, a lot of disappointment and anger at corporate executives and Enron and HealthSouth and the like, and in the mutual fund industry. He's named also hedge funds and Wall Street. There's much blame to go around. I would hope, Robert, if I can speak to you and other investors personally, there still is a benefit for your long-term retirement to invest some of your money in this great engine of which we call the corporate America. I think we have great ingenuity and great workers in America, and you can benefit in retirement. You can do it safely through passive investing in index funds where somebody's not trying to pick a stock here and pick a stock there, and it's diversified and it's low cost. And you might want to do that certainly in the interim rather than checking out completely. You might check into a safer home, and that's called index investing.
Robert, thank you so much for the call. Paul, what do you think? What would you say to Robert? Can the SEC be trusted to fix this and perhaps help him get some of his confidence back?
Well, it's certainly the challenge that we have. I mean, I think that it is well documented that our agency has been starved for resources. Fortunately, the Congress has given more money for us to expand our staff, expand our resources, expand our use of technology. I mean, I've been there for 5 years, and I can tell you that, you know, I serve on the technology committee there at the commission. And, you know, when we were looking at our budget in terms of what we can do in terms of employing new technologies to be able to ferret out and identify abusive activity, we actually had very little money left over than, you know, after we paid for the existing computers and PCs that we had to really think, you know, out of the box in terms of how we might use technology to help us oversee the markets and do a better job. So we have more money. We're going to apply those wisely, and the chairman has embarked upon a program for us to analyze how we employ those resources, how we can identify risk, how we can look over the hill, around the corner. And indeed, you know, we have a big challenge to restore the confidence of investors like Robert that, you know, we can find this activity rooted out. And again, I go back to the penalties here. In the mutual fund area, you know, I think folks got to pay a big price when they in these situations where they just betrayed the investors. And I think if we can do that, you know, we can go a long way towards cleaning this mess up.
I think, Paul, if I might ask, will you see yourself going further to the place where I think the core issue is in mutual fund governance?
Mm-hmm.
You were right that the SEC does not set pricing, and I think that's the way America should be. It should be set out there in the private market. But Congress said there is an independent board of fiduciaries, and today I strongly believe they have not been acting as fiduciaries when it comes to price, performance, and service.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that of 9,000 mutual funds, just about none of them have gone out to seriously look to find a new service provider, maybe a new management company, when we all know that out of those 9,000, at least 500 to 1,000 are in the bottom decile of performance, and we've just learned that Putnam and others have breached their contracts of service. So shouldn't the Putnam fund directors act independently and seriously go out and see if there might be some other management company to serve their investors' needs the same way that a state pension board might do?
Paul, what about that?
Well, let me say first of all that, you know, we're going to proceed, you know, methodically and quickly and hopefully not recklessly. I mean, the first thing that the chairman's charged us with doing, obviously, is the investigation and the enforcement prong of this. I'm in the rulemaking area, and I can tell you that later this month we're going to be sending a package of rules to the commission to deal specifically with the abuses that have been identified thus far, the late trading that Ian outlined, the market timing abuses, other abuses like the selective disclosure of portfolio information that has turned up in some of these matters that we're looking at now. So that's going to be the first priority. And then I think we have to address what Gary's talking about, structural you know, considerations in terms of how funds are run and managed and the role of the independent directors. And how do you get independent directors to truly negotiate, you know, with the management companies with regard to fees and other issues? How do you get them focusing on compliance and whether or not the compliance systems and controls are adequate so that we avoid these kinds of problems? So I think you're seeing this emerge in the congressional hearings. You're seeing a lot of interest on the Hill in terms of these issues, and we're also very interested at the Securities and Exchange Commission about doing what we can do within the regulatory authority that we have, and perhaps there'll even be legislation that gives us additional authority to attack this kind of problem.
All right. Lots of listeners want to get in on this conversation, as you might imagine. Maeve is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Perfectly. Just perfectly. Thank you very much. How long do you think the investigation will take before we find answers? Will taxpayers' money be used in that process, and how much? And thirdly, will we realistically see prosecutions this time? Because I think that will be really critical to restore confidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm particularly pleased to answer Maeve's question since I grew up in Louisville. And I can assure you that in terms of the time of the investigation, I can't give you a time frame. All I can tell you is that we're moving quickly on this. This is a priority for the commission. And we're going to follow this wherever it takes us as long as it takes. And, yes, unfortunately, there's taxpayer money. You know, you pay our salaries and the salaries of our enforcers, you know, to pursue this type of activity. And I can tell you that a component of the resolution here to this matter is going to be obtaining restitution. You know, to the extent that there's been overreaching and dilution of fund investors, one of our priorities is going to be to get that money back to the funds and to the investors. And you know, with your question, are people going to go to jail this time? The answer is absolutely yes. And you've already seen a number of enforcement actions. You're seeing criminal actions brought by the New York Attorney General. You're going to see the SEC making referrals to U.S. attorneys across the country on this.
Now, what about that? I did want to get into some of the particulars, Paul, because what are the mechanics? The SEC brings charges, or these attorneys general across the country bring the charges, or both, or what?
Well, I think you're going to see you know, a combined effort. The New York Attorney General in particular has both civil and criminal authority. He can pursue both civil charges and put people in jail when they've committed a crime. The SEC, we're more limited. We can pursue people civilly. We can bar them from the industry. We can impose penalties and fines. We can get injunctions against them, barring them continuing in violative activity. And then we have to make the referrals to the Justice Department, the U.S. attorneys for prosecution. And I assure you that there's interest on the part of U.S. attorneys in this area, and we're going to be making the referrals where we think it's appropriate.
Maeve, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina now and hear from Hugh. Hi, Hugh. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? I want to make the point that I feel that the SEC has also betrayed the American public and investors. The record of the SEC in terms of enforcement is very poor. For example, from 1992 to 2001, there were only 609 cases referred for prosecution. Only 87 resulted in prison terms. The SEC is seriously understaffed and inexperienced. They have a tremendous turnover of employees. I think the average employee lasts something like 3.5 years.
Hugh, where are you getting these numbers? You have really done your homework here.
Well, I haven't. Actually, I'm quoting, and I should give him credit, the New York Times reporter, Alex Burns, in the numbers. I also have done a good deal of other reading on the subject. I'm a former accountant. I would say, too, the SEC, for example, has reviews something like 2,280 annual reports out of the 14,000 that are filed. And 8,500 filings of the 99,000 that are filed annually. I believe the reason for this, and I think this is critical, is that the Republican administration does not want an effective SEC. They have tried to slash their budget whenever the SEC, for example, Chairman Leavitt, has tried to do reforms. They've threatened.
All right, Hugh, I think we've got you on that. Paul was mentioning that a moment earlier. Quick response if we can get one, Paul.
Well, I'm sorry that he's disappointed in the SEC, but he goes on to point out the funding issue, which is really to some extent, to a large extent, handicapped us. I mean, we can't review all the filings that he talked about because of resource constraints. And fortunately, Congress has given us the additional resources, and we're going to use those wisely. We're going to employ those resources. A lot of it's going into enforcement. And I would just point out that if he goes back and he looks at the enforcement numbers from our last fiscal year, I think we brought over 600 enforcement cases, which was about a 40% increase over the previous year. And that was without additional resources. So I assure you there are a lot of people working hard at the SEC. We have an obligation to be a lot of places, and we're working hard to try to be there.
Connection listeners, we're talking this hour about charges of illegal and unethical behavior swirling around some of the biggest mutual fund firms in the country. What about you? Have you lost trust? And do you think the SEC can get it back? What's your plan for investing from here on in? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. If you have mutual funds, and 95 million Americans do, you may have been looking at those recent headlines and wondering what the charges of illegal and unethical behavior by managers of some of the top firms means for you. Have you thought about the pros and the cons of getting out of mutual funds? What would you like to understand better about the best steps for you to be taking now? We invite you to join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And our guests this hour are Paul Roy, Director of Investment Management at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and Gary Gensler, a former Treasury Department official and author of The Great Mutual Fund Trap. Gary, we heard Paul say a moment ago, explaining some of the budgetary constraints at the SEC. I put it to you, is the SEC up to the job here?
Oh, I think that the SEC is up to the job, but it's a question of political will. They will come forward with a number of fixes, and I'm sure they'll fix this market timing issue. But the real issue is governance. That's governance of mutual funds, which is broken, sorely broken. And will they have the political support, not at Paul's level, but at the commission and within the Bush administration, and ultimately Congress as their overseers, to address this governance issue? I think we all know what needs to happen, that the boards of directors need to act as true fiduciaries. If you and I were on that board, we'd want to negotiate for the lowest fees, for the best service. Sometimes you would pay a little extra for better service or better performance. And will the SEC say something very real in rules and regulations to address that? For instance, they could just say that Fidelity's asset managers could charge whatever they want, but the boards representing you and me, the investors, would have to inquire and judge those fees in relation to what Fidelity charges other people, not just mutual funds, but charges private firms. Or to even go further, that you'd have to go out and negotiate with others to get the best service performance at appropriate fees.
So, Paul, what about that? I mean, is this more a matter of internal governance than external ones, or is it a combination that really needs to be put into place?
Well, I think that there are governance issues that need to be examined, and I think that one thing I would point out is that this is not a new issue for the SEC. Several years ago, we focused on the governance issues. It was the SEC that proposed rules that effectively required mutual funds today to have a majority of independent directors, where the statute only says that 40% have to be independent. We promoted rules that required, when there are vacancies on a fund board, to require those vacancies to be filled by a committee consisting wholly of independent directors to fill those vacancies. We advanced the concept of independent legal counsel for fund directors, because all their information comes from the management company who's running the fund group. And we wanted to give them access to independent legal advice so they would know, have someone to go to ask the right questions, to pursue the right areas of inquiry. We forced additional disclosures about directors and potential conflicts. Do directors own shares of the funds that they oversee? So these are areas that we focused on and have adopted rules. But I think, as recent events illustrate, we've got to do more in terms of bolstering compliance, focusing on the issue that Gary highlighted, getting directors to really understand their fiduciary obligations and what it really means to negotiate on behalf of investors.
Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island now and hear from Christina, who I understand, Christina, you worked in the industry. What did you see there?
Well, I guess the problem that I saw over many years is that there were a lot of former CPAs who had once had the responsibility of auditing the funds, and perhaps for one reason or another they weren't going to stay with the firm. They ended up coming over to the mutual fund firm, and they were maybe the head of the fund accounting area or head of the transfer agent area. And it was very hard sometimes to raise an issue with them because they would get really bogged down in that sort of CPA mindset of, well, is this really material? When it was clearly something of, it's an issue of whether, to me, it was it's right or it's wrong. And sometimes, in looking back on hearing some of the things that have come out in the papers in the last week or so, in my mind, it was like, how did this ever pass through the semi-annual audit process? Why was this not picked up? Even if it was missed in an internal audit, how could the external, auditors be signing off on these funds on an annual basis?
Okay, Christina, thanks. Good question. Let's pose it to Gary first.
Well, I think that, unfortunately, two things occurred. One is, I think that you have a very passive, I might even say, asleep at the switch governance. I hate to bring it all back to that, but you have boards of trustees coming in the Bank America situation. These boards sat on 80 boards simultaneously, the nation's fund boards. They come in quarterly. They get a quick report on those 80 funds. It's almost beyond human imagination that you could get to the level of detail to catch these things. I would say they're not being thoughtful, being on 80 boards and doing it only once a quarter. So as Paul said earlier, Christina, they need better compliance and they need to really shake the system up. I think Nations Fund should publicly announce that they're going to talk to other service providers. What if Nations Fund said to Bank of America, we're going to go talk to Fidelity. They seem pretty clean. I hope Fidelity's clean. Maybe we'll find out tomorrow they're not. Well, I bet you that board will have done more for their investors just by making that public announcement. Bank of America would probably clean up its act pretty fast.
Well, Christina, you seem to be suggesting, though, that this really is a pervasive corporate culture. So
yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I think part of not only the corporate culture, but too much of an inside culture. A large mutual fund company, in most cases, has too much of their services in-house. Their
yes.
fund accounting is all in-house. Their transfer agent is all in-house. And then you've got some of these, you know, when an issue is raised, it's not that same sort of maybe threat if you were an outside provider where you say, oh, my word, if we don't clean this up, the mutual fund company is going to fire us. We're not going to be able to do
right.
their fund accounting any longer.
Christina puts her finger on the core. America business works best when there's competition. That's what our capitalist system is about. And she's identified this is more about monopolies. The mutual fund has a monopoly. The mutual fund company has a monopoly with its mutual fund family. And all these services are not negotiated or competitively looked at.
Well, how do you do that, Gary? I mean, is it possible for small investors to say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay that fee. We're going to have to negotiate this. And if you want my business, it's going to be less.
For a small investor, there's really only one thing to do right now, and it's to say there's one company that does it right, and that's Vanguard, because Vanguard, the management company, is owned by you, the investors. And I think that's the only game in town that does it, and thus the conflict goes away.
But otherwise, it's mostly like a casino in which the house always wins regardless?
This is a casino where the house wins. For regulators, and what I would be stressing to the SEC, is use as much authority as you currently have to address to these governance issues. And, of course, Congress, it would be great if they helped the SEC out.
Paul, I'm sure you'd concur with that. Are we talking about more rules that are needed here? More obviously, you'd like more of a budget to be able to do what you do more effectively. What's it come down to?
Well, I think it is going to come down to more rules. And I would just, going back to Christina's question in terms of everything being done internally within the service providers to the fund, the management company, the affiliated transfer agents, those kinds of operations, that one proposal that we have outstanding and that we intend to recommend adoption to the commission later this month is the requirement that every fund have a compliance officer, a chief compliance officer, that reports and is accountable to the fund, to the board of directors, with a set of procedures that are reasonably designed to assure that they're complying with the federal securities laws, that the fund and all its service providers have the mechanisms and controls in place to provide for compliance. And that chief compliance officer reporting to those independent directors. We see that as part of the solution, but I think as Gary alludes to, there needs to be more, and that's what we're going to be thinking about.
All right, we want to go to Aiken, South Carolina now and hear from Steve. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. I appreciate y'all taking my call. Excuse me. I agree with Christina on the external audits. I'm surprised it hasn't been caught to date. But something of interest to me, and certainly probably the average American investor who probably is not a large investor at any particular time, that's one of the reasons they invest in mutual funds. Just have a quick question for you. What is the percentage of the market that is mutual fund type investments as opposed to open market? And also whether or not you have worried or concerns relative to individuals panicking and getting out of the investment markets and ultimately a domino effect similar to 1929.
Well, Steve, the mutual fund industry owns about a quarter of the stock market. And that, by the way, is a good point to say. That's why they're going to be the stock market performance before all their considerable fees and costs. And that's why for a small investor, you've got to focus on the costs. I do worry a little bit about confidence. After the Enron and WorldCom situation, we had a bigger worry about that because it was a question of people cooking books and whether you could even trust the financials. But there's probably a worthy concern for people at the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Treasury and elsewhere to do the right thing here to rebuild confidence.
And, Paul, what's the government's role there as well? I mean, what can the government do to restore confidence among investors?
Well, I think it's our responsibility to, as I indicated before, to look into these situations and put the information out there. You know, we're concerned about confidence, but I think we have an obligation to the American investors to, you know, when we see problems and see issues, to force that information out there. You're seeing a lot of information coming out. It's coming out quickly, and we're trying to get at the scope of this, and we're trying to, you know, get our arms around it and deal with people appropriately. The information's there, but I think it's also fair, you know, for investors in mutual funds really not to panic. I mean, I think they should monitor what we're doing. You know, they should be assured that, again, we're going to try to get restitution of the money back to the funds. And indeed, you've seen many of the major fund groups that have been implicated in this so far saying that they're going to make restitution on their own. And I assure you that if they don't do it on their own, we're going to be there to make sure that it gets done. And then on top of that restitution, what else should we exact from them? You know, we want to make sure that each of these firms that gets implicated is clean when we leave there.
Steve, what do you think? I don't know if you have mutual funds, but if you do, are you going to stay or go?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I haven't given rise to the panic aspect of it yet. I'm going to stay put for a while and keep my eyes on things, see how they develop. I think it's important that you know, the government comes out in a timely manner and really, you know, puts a foot on this. And sounds like, you know, they're taking the correct steps. I think you know, your type program is going to go a long way towards you know, keeping people informed, and I think that's utmost in importance right now.
But, Steve, watch for real reform, not just fake reform.
Absolutely.
There's some in Congress and elsewhere and in the industry who will want to pass fake reform off as real reform.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate your call, and keep up the good work.
All right, Steve, we appreciate your call. Gary, what would be your advice to the small investor at this point? It's not all that clear-cut, is it, as to whether you should stay or go?
Oh, I think it's actually pretty clear that for a small investor, think first about your asset allocation. How much of your assets are you comfortable having in the stock market versus something more secure like bonds or even cash? And then what you put in the stock market, if that's, let's say, half of your money, do it wisely for the long term, and that means low-cost, passive investing, which is called index funds or their cousins, exchange-traded funds, and you'll get fees and costs that are one-tenth the fees and costs otherwise charged to you.
All right, Gary, sounds like good advice. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Gail.
Gary Gensler is author of The Great Mutual Fund Trap. He's also a former senior official in the Treasury Department during the Clinton administration. Also, Paul Roy, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
He is Director of Investment Management at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Earlier in the program, we heard from Ian McDonald, who writes about mutual funds for The Wall Street Journal. And you can continue the conversation on our website, theconnection.org. We had help today from Glenn Alexander and Matt Largie. Our producer in Baghdad is Mark Allard. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection.